when I was picking beans in Guatemala, we used to make fresh coffee right off the trees. I mean, that was good. Coffee get at the grocery store is shit, but hey, it was probably roasted months ago. Of course, you don't have to go to Guatemala to get fresh coffee, you just have to go to sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. They even offer autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. So what are you waiting for? It's time to fill that Kobayashi mug with the best coffee you've ever had, made at home. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Give me the keys to your coffee truck, you cocksucker motherfucker, yeah!
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey gang, and we thank you several times over for downloading the Next 100 Project, the weekly analysis of classic movies by Team Ellis. There's no better time than right now to warn you that we spoil bushels of films, especially the one in question today. I am the easily duped customs agent in charge, Ryan Ellis, and with me is the duplicitous storytelling mass murderer, including of his own family, or her own family, my doe-eyed wife, Bev.
That's me.
We're Team Ellis. Wonder powers activate. That was dumb. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Usual Suspects, and it's a softball right down the middle of the plate. Hit a home run, Bev. Bryan Singer's production company and the name of this movie, The Usual Suspects, come from which two classic motion picture films?
Well, the easy one is The Usual Suspects, which comes from Casablanca, a classic line where Claude Rains orders the cops to round up the usual suspects to account for a crime. Bathead Harry, I had to look up. Bathead Harry is the name of Bryan Singer's production company. Mm-hmm. It's from a kind of off-the-cuff line in Jaws, when Sheriff Brody won't bathe with all the bathers. He won't go in the water because he's afraid of water. One of the senior citizens who knows him gives him a hard time.
We know all about you, Chief. You won't go in the water at all. That's some bad hat, Harry.
Right.
Also, Blue Parrot is a production company involved in this picture, and that's also from Casablanca. That's the name of Rick's rival, or maybe he's not so much rival, but the fat man, Sidney Greenstreet, plays him. That's the name of his club, and of course, Rick's is Café Américain, so a lot of references to other movies right off the bat, and of course, this movie does homage a lot of classic films. That was an easy softball, and you did hit a home run. Way to go.
Yes.
The Next 100 Project's 76th moving film thingy, The Usual Suspects, was not nominated for the 1998 or 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Polygram and Gramercy, although I think now MGM has the rights to this movie, but those two companies showed it at a few film festivals in 1995, then The Flicker Show was released on September 15th, 1995. Made on a pittance, it earned a nice load of bucks, and Bryan Singer, the director, also shot the movie very quickly. So, Bev, explain what The Usual Suspects is about for those who've not seen it in a while or never saw it or whatever with the skinny.
Kevin Spacey is Verbal Kint, a low-level career criminal whose police interrogation helps to unravel the complex tale of five criminals brought together by a mysterious crime lord to pull off an elaborate heist.
Who's the mysterious crime lord?
It's a mystery.
Or, in a nutshell, evidence of burn victim's eyewitness testimony arrives seconds too late. Turn to the right, Agent Kuyan! He's right there! Or, I don't worry about you, Kaiser! You won't fold under questioning! Although he does a little bit at times, and we'll talk about that as the movie plays out here. I've been using that line a lot lately, but long live Joe Pesci in Goodfellas with that great line. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 88% of critics like The Usual Suspects, 61 fresh, 8 rotten, and 96% of audiences. The movie is 26th on the IMDb's 250, which is one of the reasons we chose to do it. It is so remarkably popular. And it was 75th at the 1995 U.S. box office. Toy Story, which we covered for the Top 100 Project, was number 1, and Braveheart, the Best Picture winner that year, was 18th. So this is a story told mostly in flashback. Does the story hold up? Does it have to hold up? But before we get to those questions, your general thoughts about The Usual Suspects.
I'm sorry to say that my teenage enthusiasm for this film has wavered some 22 years later. It's still fun as hell to watch, but it gets way more credit than it deserves for being a smart thriller. I'm using quotation marks, smart.
I agree. I was never a big fan of this movie. I've seen it 3 times. I think the first was not that long after it came out. I didn't see the theater, though. The second time was around 2000 when I lived with a guy who owned it. I thought, I gotta see this movie, see if I was wrong the first time. Still didn't love it. And this viewing, which we got from our friend Andre, by the way, thanks Andre, got the Blu-ray from him. I can appreciate it, but I don't know if I love it. I seriously, I wouldn't give it a 26 on the IMDb kind of ranking at all. It's okay. A marginal thumbs up at best, and maybe even a marginal thumbs down for me.
IMDb ranking notwithstanding, do you think that the biggest strike against this film is its popularity? That it's simply overrated? If it was just a film you kind of discovered that flew under the radar, do you think you would enjoy it more, or is it all the praise that ruins it?
Well, let me take myself back to the mid-90s when I first saw it. I don't remember if I heard the twist, but I feel like I guessed the twist. It's so long ago, I've told that story before, just like in The Sixth Sense, I know I guessed that twist, and I don't think I heard what it was, but I leaned over to a friend during The Sixth Sense, when that was on the big screen, and said, "He's dead already." There's a spoiler, but...
Spoiler alert!
Oh, for God's sake. This one, when I saw it on DVD, or probably even videotape, actually, I think I knew what was going to happen, or guessed before it was going to happen, and also thought, I don't know if that really holds up, and I also don't know if I really care.
Well, that's a good criticism right there. It's one thing to say, I don't know if the plot necessarily makes sense, I don't know if it holds up, a twist, but to say you don't care, that's a legit criticism.
It's a fake drug deal, this whole big scheme with the five of them, and it was always just a simple hit, which is clever, I suppose, but I don't really know if it matters. I guess it does to Kaiser Sose and the poor guy he was shooting and killing. But he was shooting and killing a lot of other people in the process. So, I guess we know. Everyone knows this by now, I guess, that Kaiser Sose is Kevin Spacey, despite the fact he pretends to be the verbal Kent guy. Now, there's a lot of hints along the way that he is the bad guy, the lighter that you see in the very beginning, and then when he's about to check out, although the movie's basically over.
It's at the tail end, yeah. By then you may have figured it out.
And I think maybe you see the lighter at some other point as well, though, when he's lighting a cigarette. I forget now, but I read that somewhere. The lighter is a hint. He talks about how his pee gets clumpy if he doesn't drink enough water or coffee or whatever the hell it is. And when Kaiser Sose, in the opening of the movie, which of course is the end of the story, almost the end of the story, is peeing on one of the fires, apparently you see a clumpy bit of pee.
Does pee get clumpy?
That's what I was reading online.
You need to drink water. You need to just go to the hospital.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, I read that online. He's got a bit of a condition. And then K.S. and K.S. Kaiser Sose, Kevin Spacey. The role was always apparently Spacey's, by the way. This is one of those movies where a lot of actors could have been various roles, but it was always going to be his. Singer and Christopher McQuarrie, I guess, intended it for him.
He wasn't a star when he got cast, not by a long shot. No. He had a few like kind of good notable roles, stuff like Glengarry Glen Ross.
And Swimming with Sharks.
He ran into Bryan Singer at Sundance and told him, "I want to be in your next film."
Because he saw Public Access that Singer directed and McQuarrie wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think Singer co-wrote that. But one other clue, well, there's probably a lot of other clues, but one other big one, Kaiser, so K-E-Y-S-E-R, equals Kaiser, as in another word for king. He's also supposed to be Turkish, and also that would be a reference, I suppose, maybe in some kind of way, to a classic film, The Godfather, Virgil the Turk, one of the guys that Pacino kills in that scene where Michael becomes a murderer, and the movie really gets going at that point.
So Virgil equals verbal?
Well, the Turk, you know, Virgil the Turk, Verbal the Turk, you know, exactly. So a lot of references to other films and a lot of hints that this is the guy.
And Sose, in Turkish, means talks a lot.
And at one point, Verbal says his real name is Roger when they're all in the jail cell. Did you guess the twist when you first saw the movie?
No, I absolutely didn't. I was completely shocked. How old was I? 17 when this movie came out. So I'm 17 years old. I'm watching the movie with my friends. Not only did I not guess the twist, but I was so blown away by it that I immediately, all of us, immediately rewound it and watched it again.
Right.
This is where I think the movie deserves a little credit, where its naysayers ignore the fact that it is extremely entertaining and watchable.
Oh yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's a Hollywood film through and through. It almost does a discredit, has this reputation of being a perfect whip smart thriller, when really, if we judge it with the same narrative standards that we apply to something like, say, Die Hard, then it wouldn't fail to meet that bar, but the bar is set, and when you try to put together the pieces of the puzzle, you find it's impossible because it's just not actually that well constructed. So no matter what, you're never really going to know what the real story and what's the invention. It's hopeless to try. It's not as clever as everybody gives us credit for, which is a shame because it really should just be marketed as a fun film that surprises you.
Maybe the plot is a house of cards.
Oh my, well said, sir.
Many years later, Kevin Spacey would go on to be in House of Cards, which we just finished watching one of the episodes about 25 minutes ago.
Well, I could write a novel's worth of reasonably good questions about this film, and I do have my share. It's like a refrigerator film. It sticks in your head and you can kind of pick it apart.
Mm-hmm.
You enjoy it, and then the second you walk away from it, you're going, wait a minute, if Kobayashi was the lawyer, was that just a pseudonym? Was any of that real?
Was any of the story real that he tells to Kuyon?
And none of the story is real, then really, why am I supposed to care?
That's why I say I don't know if I really give a shit.
If you don't know the twist, watching the movie for the first time is such a pleasure. It's such a surprise. But when you know the twist and you go back, you don't get nearly as much value out of the film because it's just too easy to pick it apart. But there's still plenty of pleasure to be had if you just keep that bar nice and low. Because there's still amazing performances. Really charming, surprisingly charming performances. And the dialogue is excellent as well. There's just one clever line after another. So each scene is really well constructed in the way that they do a great job of making a classic conflict set up and having a scene play out with entertaining characters in a way that keeps the pace moving and keeps the tone really consistent. It's a very good movie.
In this case, the parts are bigger than the sum.
Yeah,
it's usually people use that line where the parts make the sum better, or however that line goes, but in this case, it's individual moments and scenes that don't really add up. But yeah, you can analyze that moment, or that scene, or that line of dialogue and say, awesome, great, terrific. But the whole big thing, it doesn't really come together.
Yeah, I think it's part of a tradition of movies that are a little more ambitious than they are bright. You know, along with something like the Matrix trilogy, or dare I say, and I know this is unpopular opinion, but I feel like a lot of Christopher Nolan movies are a little more ambitious than he's actually capable of pulling off. But when you make an entertaining enough film, especially on the first viewing, it's fun to feel a little challenged along with being entertained.
But you talked about reasonably good questions, and the first one I've got is, this brilliant killer concocts a big hit, but he makes up his alibi in the customs agent's office.
So this is my theory. I think this actually makes the film better when you think of it this way. Verbal Kint is more like the real Kaiser Soze than this image of Kaiser Soze.
Well, he's playing a character.
He's built up,
he's
right?
He's an actor playing a character. I always love that. Actors acting.
Soze, the name Soze means talks a lot, has a gift for gab, and a gift for making up stories. He's a con man, right? So Soze, being who he is, concocts this image of a ruthless, terrifying killer, this tough guy. You know, you see that image and silhouette of the long flowing hair and the fire behind him. He's just murdered his family. But what we learn is that while he is deeply sociopathic and that story about killing his family may be true, he's really a charismatic con man, and he probably takes pleasure in weaving these yarns for people like the cops, people like the criminals that he's manipulating. He's so committed to the role, quote-unquote, of Verbal Kint. He spent time in prison as Verbal. Yeah. They talk about how he has a rap sheet. So he has to have assumed this identity of Roger Kint, whoever that was, enough that he did time as Kint, just so he could be convincing as this low-level criminal that's going to infiltrate.
Kind of like Leo in The Departed. He had to go to jail for a little while. When he's first recruited by Wahlberg and Martin Sheen, they say you have to do a little time in jail to make this seem believable enough. Maybe that's an homage to this picture or these kinds of pictures, old film noir type movies as well. I think White Heat may be the same idea. I love White Heat. You've never seen that movie,
have
you?
No, I haven't.
Edmund O'Brien goes to jail so he can get in good with James Cagney, and then he gets in good with his gang to infiltrate so he can bring him down.
And my theory is that Soze takes pleasure in like digging into this role and screwing over all these people and fooling them. Still deeply sociopathic and obviously a genius. Only in movies is there somebody who's this smart and capable as Kaiser Soze.
Yeah. Well, there's two moments when Kuyan is interrogating him, and I'm sure it's very deliberate. It's not an accident by an actor and a director not noticing what happened. When Kuyan is a little bit on Kaiser Soze, well, I guess he's just Verbal Kint at that point, but he's kind of on him a little bit. He's giving him a hard time. Not quite attacking him, but he's getting physical.
Yeah.
The cripple, who cannot move his left arm, very slightly moves it as if to block himself, because it's an instinct to do that. Verbal Kint is a great character actor, but he forgets for a minute, I can't move that arm, but he does. But of course, Kuyan doesn't notice it. The other one, I didn't pick up on this, but I read this online. I tried to listen for it. I can't find the clip online to look back, and we gave the movie back to Andre, so I can't even look that way. That he apparently says, when he's being berated towards the end of the movie by Kuyan, I kill Keaton, which of course he does. So there's a few moments in the interrogation where he does crack a little bit, and then maybe that goes back on my thing about how he doesn't fold under questioning, but still, he doesn't really, because Kuyan doesn't even notice those things. I'm smarter than you, Verbal.
Oh my god, that's the thing. He says it so many times. So you're stupid, I'm smarter than you. Once you've watched the film a few times, you can just imagine that when Soze walks away, just how much he's going to sink his teeth into the pleasure of knowing how badly he got him. All those times that he was taunting him and saying he's smarter than him, and meanwhile, he was going so far as to say, I killed Keaton right in front of him. And that dope didn't pick up what was going on right in front of his face. Mm-hmm. Couldn't pick up that this guy wasn't just lying. He was lying for fun. He's making up details about when he was in Guatemala picking coffee beans or when he was in a barbershop quartet just to mess with him. Just so he could spend the rest of his career kicking himself for all the details that he missed in that specific interrogation.
The guy was picking this off the bulletin board in the bottom of the coffee mug, which is a cool moment, a really fun ending to the movie. But like I say, I didn't think it held up then. But it's definitely... a great ending may be debatable because they don't really fully believe it, but it's a cool ending for sure. But even within his story about what really happened but didn't really happen, Verbal talks about being involved in armed robbery and murder. So whether he has immunity or not, why is he allowed to go free?
Because he has immunity. They gave him immunity.
But he's saying that he killed people.
Okay, listen, it's a Hollywood version of how the justice system works, and Hollywood's super guilty of feeling like really flexible about how immunity works. But the idea is that because he was just the lackey criminal, he never pulled the trigger. He never personally kills anybody in his story. He just witnesses the killings, and he certainly aids and abets the killings, and continues to work with murderers after he watches them commit murder. So the idea is that the cops just wanting him to spill his guts so that they can convict whoever they really feel was responsible.
Mm-hmm.
In movies, at least, cops certainly seem very interested in breaking down all the steps in the ladder, whatever it takes to get to the top guy. You know, it's like vampires. If you kill the head vampire, they all die. I know it only works that in certain vampire tales.
And everybody we care about, or at least that they want to get, is dead. Except for Sose, but then that's supposed to be that was Keaton, because at the end, Kuyon, well, not the very end, but at the end of his interview with Sose, his interrogation, he thinks that Keaton is the guy. And he's dead.
Do you think that the cop was doing the classic cop thing where he just wanted the evidence to match his theory? You know, he had this idea probably. Right off the beginning. He has this bee in his bonnet about Keaton because
he was a dirty ex-cop.
Yeah, so he was motivated to believe that he was this super-duper bad guy who was such an evil genius that he pulled the wool over all these mm-hmm. cops' eyes, and what could be worse than a corrupt cop who makes him look bad? So he just was super invested in Keaton being Sose. And Sose himself, Verbal, obviously takes advantage of that.
You know who was also invested in being Kaiser Sose? Gabriel Byrne, who played Dean Keaton. He thought he was Kaiser Sose until the premiere, until he saw the movie.
What? Really?
I've read that for years online, that he and Bryan Singer were out in the hallway, and I guess he was mad about it. Well, I'm not the actual guy. Because at one point he appears in the outfit that Kaiser Sose has on, because that's just a ruse. But he was wearing the outfit, so he probably thought, well, I got to be the guy if I'm wearing this outfit.
Oh, right.
And, of course, with clever editing, you can do any number of things where you think, well, why wouldn't you have seen Spacey? Because he wouldn't have had to be on set when Spacey is playing Kaiser Sose in that same outfit, which, by the way, looks a lot like the outfit that Spacey wore the same year in Seven in the chase scene when Brad Pitt and he run all over the place. He's got the same kind of hat and trench coat on.
That's true. Did nobody on set, none of the actors, see
apparently,
the whole script?
Singer convinced all of them that they were Kaiser Sose, which doesn't make a lot of sense because it really has to come down to Byrne, or I guess you could argue it. Well, no one would have probably thought, except for... I guess I did, but I don't know if I really did. I forget, it's been so long. But no one would have thought it would have been Verbal, so it would have had to be Dean Keaton or somebody else altogether.
Well, obviously it wasn't Fenster.
Well, there you go. We talked about murder. Why kill Fenster? And presumably Sose either hired somebody to do it or did it himself.
He kills Fenster to motivate them to do what he says.
Simple as that,
to just prove that he's serious. You know, he's got five guys.
And it does unite them.
Yeah, so it serves both purposes, both to convince them to do everything he says, because their lives are genuinely threatened, and it unites them together. Although you think it would unite them against Sose, particularly because Fenster and McManus are the only two people in the group of five who had a previous relationship.
They're already a team.
Yeah, they're already very close, so McManus is obviously going to be mad at Sose for that. Mm-hmm.
Well, also, it's a nice bit of trivia that the packages that they'll get from Kobayashi, or whatever his name actually is, well, I guess it isn't, because that's part of the story that Verbal creates. It's Kobayashi is on the mug. Another homage, another influence. That's got to be from the Kobayashi Maru in Star Trek 2.
Oh, yeah.
The test,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
But anyway, whatever Pete Postlethwaite's actual name is, he hands all the packages to all these guys for the assignment, and they get the packages in the order that they die. Fenster's first, and so on.
I'm going to ask another reasonably good question here. About the origin of this group of five, and that is, who the fuck plots a serious crime with strangers that they met in a jail cell?
Well, that's
or in a police lineup.
That's a setup, too. The lineup. There's two famous scenes in this movie, just like last week's movie, Zero Dark Thirty. as many other good scenes as there may be, people remember those two scenes the most in Zero Dark Thirty, those two moments, whatever, those two sequences.
The torture and the raid, yeah.
The torture and the raid. Torture at the beginning, raid at the end. Usual Suspects, it's the lineup scene near the beginning, and then the big twist at the very end. And it is said by Kobayashi that they all stole from Kaiser Sose, so that's why they've been brought together, because they have to pay. Whether they intended to steal from him or not, they're going to pay. So he went after guys he thought were good, probably guys he thought he could trust in the criminal underworld, and also he probably knew he was going to kill them all along because they did steal from him.
Yeah, he wanted to kill two birds with one stone. If you look at it from the very beginning, try to step back and look from his point of view, Sose, he has people that he wants to get revenge on, and he has a witness that he wants murdered. So he conspires to have these people he wants to get revenge on to kill the witness that he wants to have murdered. Or help him kill this witness. Lied to them about there being drugs on the boat. Kills them just like he wants to all along. But has used them to this end goal. And as he says at some point in the film, if you don't have any friends, if you don't have any co-workers or whatever, like partners, then you don't have anybody that can turn on you. So I suppose this is how he gets people to work for him. There's this thing that movies do that I find completely unconvincing, which is they always have like these little gangs of criminals where one boss picks random strangers to Reservoir work Dogs. Together. Reservoir Dogs is super guilty of this. I find it very hard to believe. Criminal elements who do those jobs specifically would know who each other are. Using pseudonyms is ridiculous. As big as LA is, how many jewel heist criminals are there?
You're talking about Dogs, not Suspects in this case.
Yeah. If I was gonna do a heist like the jewel heist in Reservoir Dogs, like the heist that they do in Usual Suspects, Baby Driver, super guilty of this as well, I wouldn't want to do this with people who I met that day or that week.
Probably killers. I will answer the Dogs thing in one big way. They talk about how they bring all these guys together and don't want them to know each other so they can't rat each other if they get caught. And we know that Harvey Keitel's character is supposedly, at least, from the Wisconsin area. And the heist is done in L.A., and that's probably where Michael Madsen's character is from. So the idea is bringing together guys from all over the country. So why would they know each other?
Reservoir Dogs does it more convincingly than most movies. But I always find it extremely hard to believe. And here we don't even have one boss orchestrating it as far as they know. It's just lucky that without verbal even making the suggestion, they're like, hey, well, we're all here in this jail cell. And we had a good laugh in the lineup, which actually I find like a really funny moment. Mm-hmm. They were meant to play that scene seriously, but the guys, the actors were in there and they just had the giggles and they kept cracking each other up. Singer chose to use that brilliant choice.
Which is why people remember the scene.
And it's why they have this immediate camaraderie, and then it becomes a little more convincing that McManus would have said, hey, since we're all here, I got this job.
The eventual job at the very end is set in San Pedro, California, and the suspects met 6 weeks earlier, so it's one of those flashback stories, like I said, where you find out all these things and the flashbacks may not be true. It's appropriate that most of it is set in New York and L.A. because that makes an homage to old crime films, I think. I mean, Chicago is a place they set a lot of old crime films, too. But generally, it was New York and especially L.A. And this movie is definitely an homage to noir films. Mm,
the voiceover narration telling the story is very noirish.
And it's
the way the cops dress.
And appropriate that it's from a guy named Verbal, although he's a shockingly unreliable narrator. And in the lineup scene, back to that, Hockney's the first one, that's Kevin Pollak, to say the line, "Give me the keys, you fucking cocksucker." And he says it in the most flat way. The rest of them do it differently. And of course, a lot of laughing is going on there too. But he's the one that robs the guns. And that's why they're in the lineup in the first place. They're all saying the line differently. They don't actually quote the line exactly.
Yeah, the crime that they're there for, he's the one that's actually guilty of it. Although, when we find this out, and the guns that he robs belong to Kaiser Sose, that's why he got in Kaiser Sose's bad books. We find that out from Kobayashi in the scene where they get the packages with their loved ones. And everybody kind of gives him a look, but it's a rather subtle moment. And it's like an hour after we heard about that crime that they were all accused of. I've seen this movie a large number of times, and I never actually put that together until you told me that. And then when I was watching it this time around, I caught that moment. Although you made another great point, which is, what's the cop's name? Detective?
Kuyong. Agent Kuyong.
Agent Kuyong says, you know, I learned when I became a cop that if you want to catch a murderer, arrest three guys. Whoever sleeps that night is the murderer. And Kevin Pollak is the one who's lying down and restful and the chillest in the jail cell because he's the one that committed that crime.
Thank you, Internet. You talked about loved ones. Well, Dean Keaton's loved one is Edie, and that's Susie Amos, now Mrs. James Cameron in real life. She doesn't really have a movie career anymore because she's his wife. What is his fourth or fifth wife? Linda Hamilton's in the news all over again now because apparently of what he's been saying lately about Wonder Woman.
Oh, yeah. Apparently being his wife is a full-time job.
But Verbal cares a lot about Keaton's relationship with Edie. Is it fake sympathy? He's putting the screws to him, I guess. He knows how to do that to people. He's using Edie against Keaton. That's the reason why Keaton gets in the job, and he's the only one who was maybe going to pull out. And then he's got the ultimate leverage. We never really meet the loved ones of the other people. McManus has a nephew or something that he mentions, but we don't meet them, but we actually see who Keaton cares about.
Well, if Verbal acts like he cares about Edie, that's obviously a lie, because he kills Edie. She's dead by the end of the film. There's a line about how she was found somewhere.
What I mean is that he's goosing that thing. He's pretending like he actually cares. But again, he's an actor who's acting in this role of this character. So at the very end, in the big twist moment, well, I guess it's before the twist moment because he's still being interviewed as Verbal Kint, he says to Kuyon, "The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist." And that's a bastardized quote from Charles Baudelaire.
I knew it couldn't possibly be strictly from Usual Suspects script, but that's probably the most famous line in the movie, and it's a great line.
Yeah. The man saying that line, Kevin Spacey, we covered him on Seven and American Beauty. He's the ultimate killer who pretends to be the ultimate coward. And it is, of course, a great performance. He won the Supporting Actor Oscar that year, although I think Ed Harris probably should have won. And Kevin Spacey said on Inside the Actor's Studio he thought Ed Harris was going to win.
What was he nominated for that year?
Harris for Apollo 13, and he had won the SAG Award. And I think Pitt won. Yes, he did. He won the Golden Globe for 12 Monkeys, so it was really split up that year. That was a great year for movies and a great year for acting. So it's not like Spacey was a bad choice, but I wouldn't have voted for him. I would have gone with Harris.
Pitt and Spacey were both in another...
In Seven.
In Seven, so I always feel like Spacey won that award for both of those.
Oh, movies. I know. That's happened before. Sean Penn, when he won in 2003 for Mystic River, it was a good performance, and he was overdue for a lot of great performances in his career, but it's also a matter of being in 21 Grams that same year, so it was two movies at once. A lot of other awards bodies will recognize you for two or three or four, however many movies you're in that year, they'll recognize them all and say, this guy was, or this woman was great in all these movies, but the Oscars is only one movie. But yes, the voters have to know, this guy was great in two things in a supporting role, Spacey in this case. This whole movie's character actors, really, most of them remain that. Spacey is, I guess, the real headliner. Yeah, he's been a headliner. I suppose it's fair to say he's not Tom Cruise, but he's a pretty big star. Gabriel Byrne, though, is in a way the lead of the movie if Spacey is the supporting actor, which is debatable, really. Is he really a supporting actor in this movie? He's kind of the lead. But Byrne is the main character in a way. He's been working for nearly 40 years, and he was great in Miller's Crossing for the Coens, and also very different the year before this movie in Little Women. He's Winona Ryder's love interest. Maybe a little miscast in that, but that's a charming, lovely movie. I haven't seen it in a while, but I love that movie. He's the first character we see in the whole film, on screen at least. He dies at 12:30, and what did we cover last week? Zero Dark Thirty.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin Pollak is Hockney. Surprisingly cool. I guess he's kind of cool in Casino, which he did the same year as this, and he's not cool in A Few Good Men. He's pretty good in that. This has never really been an actor, per se. He's a comedian who does act. Now he's got his podcast. He plays a badass very well in this movie.
All five of them are a little too cool for school sometimes. When the cops come to arrest Kevin Pollak or just pick him up for that lineup, he's got all these clever lines, all these wisecracks, he's always smoking, and it's a little over the top, but that machismo is fun to watch.
Benicio del Toro, I guess maybe is the most talked about guy in the whole movie other than Spacey, and for some people maybe including Spacey. He's a very dedicated character actor. Traffic won him the Oscar the year after Spacey won an Oscar. Well, Spacey won two, but he won for American Beauty, and then a year later, Benicio wins for Traffic and supporting role. He's got this recurring Sicario character now because he was the supporting player in that to Emily Blunt. But the sequel they're doing to Sicario is going to be about him, I guess, now. And, of course, he's going to be in the Marvel movies now as the, what do they call him, the Collector? Yeah, yes. He's the Collector. He was in Guardians, and we'll see him again. He's very soft-spoken in this movie, and of course, very hard to understand. We thought Andre the Giant was hard to understand in Princess Bride a few weeks ago, but wow. Very deliberately, and that was Del Toro's idea to go with this indecipherable voice.
A speech impediment.
Kevin Pollak at one point even says, what did he say? And that was apparently Pollak going off script and saying, I didn't understand the line.
He determined that his character's chief purpose was just to die to increase the peril for the other characters and to give him motivation so he could do whatever he wanted with his affectation, since it was all thematically irrelevant, hence the barely comprehensible speech. This character really stands out for being one of his more chameleon roles, even though it was one of his first roles. Mm. And he looks so young in this movie. It's crazy. Between this and Traffic, 5 years later, it's like he aged decades.
Spacey recommended him, and they were both in Swimming with Sharks, so I'm guessing that Spacey recommended him because they were in the same movie the year before this. Stephen Baldwin, who's so cool in this, just like Pollock, probably even more so than Pollock, had been in Born on the 4th of July in a movie we talked about during this movie, Threesome, the year before this. And at this point, right after this movie came out, Stephen was probably the Baldwin with the best rep, including Alec. That's not true anymore.
Yeah, Alex's star was kind of falling at this point, and his was rising. And you watch him in this movie, and it's hard to imagine how it fell apart for him. He is pure charm. He has so much screen presence. He has such incredible charisma, and he just kills it in this part. Although we know that he's behind the scenes kind of a dick.
He's a religious nut now, I think. Right-wing guy.
Okay, so
which doesn't help you in Hollywood. Although they always say Hollywood is more right-wing than left-wing. People say publicly, it's a left-wing place. It's so liberal. But really, anybody who's rich tends to lean right, and it's maybe more secretly right-wing. People probably say when they're listening to this podcast, oh, you're full of shit. I've heard that from a lot of people, that despite all the public Barbara Streisand-type stuff, George Clooney left-wing type thing, that really there's more right-wing behind-the-scenes stuff. But I think his thing is more religious, and I don't know how close he is to his brothers anymore, because, of course, Alec especially is nothing like that at all. He's hardcore left-wing, and he, I don't think, is a very religious guy. And Alec, of course, for many years now, has been by far the biggest Baldwin star. I mean, he's become a huge player in the business because of 30 Rock, some of the movie roles he's been in, and he's also a very political presence. I don't know if he was so much in the mid-90s. And like we say, his star had been falling at that point.
He's just pretty generally beloved, too.
Despite the fact he's a dick.
Yeah, he's also kind of a known asshole, and his SNL stuff, even.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Performing as Trump this past Trump, year, yeah.
Chaz Palminteri as Agent Kuyon had been in A Bronx Tale in 93, Bullets Over Broadway, which got him an Oscar nomination in 94, and he's been acting all this time, a lot of good work, but that was a great run, and he didn't really maintain it, I wouldn't say, because he really talks about Chaz Palminteri in any kind of major way, but just like Stephen Baldwin, a little bit fell off the map, I guess you could argue, but he's been acting all this time, as has Dan Hedaya, who's been working for 45 plus years. He was great in Blood Simple in 84 for the Coens, and then, of course, his best role, I think, is Nick on Cheers.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Giancarlo Esposito is pretty good, too. Do the Right Thing, he's in that. The irritating Bugging Out. And more famously, Gus Fring on Breaking Bad and now Better Call Saul. But he's pretty solid in the role of the guy who's investigating the crime. And he's the one that comes away with the facts that shows Kaiser Sose's face, which, of course, is Kevin Spacey's character.
Yeah, they had to keep kind of a B-list of actors and C-list. They didn't have any big stars in the movie because their budget was very small. And they shot it in a very short period of time.
That's probably because the director was making his first major movie. Bryan Singer, he'd done Public Access a couple of years before this. He's known mostly for the X-Men movies. He's directed four of them at this point. The first two, and then Days of Future Past and Apocalypse. But he also did Superman Returns, and that was not a very good film. He's made plenty of good movies. At Pupil was fine as well. Not wonderful or anything, but it was okay. Worked well with Ian McKellen in that, as he, of course, did in the X-Men films. And it's a pretty impressive task to convince all of them that they were the bad guy in the movie. I would have loved to have been behind the scenes to watch that happen.
I don't think he's a genius or an auteur, but Singer is a pretty good Hollywood director. He's a great Hollywood director. He makes very entertaining films that are thematically consistent. Many movies that you've named are movies that I've watched many times over just because they're fun. I really love the first, well, I love actually most of the X-Men movies, even the Brett Ratner one.
I do too.
That's right. We like X-Men 3. Deal with it.
I don't know why it's supposedly so bad.
I don't know why everyone hates it so much. I agree.
Brett Ratner may be a scum, but he also did a good movie called Red Dragon. It's a damn good version of the Hannibal Lecter story.
We like lots of movies made by terrible people. Mm-hmm. You can't be A-okay with Woody Allen or Roman Polanski movies and give Brett Ratner a hard time. Wait, give Brett Ratner a very hard time for being a shithead, because he's absolutely a shithead. But
that same year, 2006, is when The Last Stand came out and Superman Returns. And I know Kevin Smith said this publicly, and I'm saying it as well. Singer's the better director, but Ratner made the better movie that year.
That's our unpopular opinion, folks.
Well, Superman Returns doesn't have that many people to love it either. Although Spacey,
oh, no, I don't defend that.
And Spacey was Lex Luthor in that, too.
Yeah.
So Chris McQuarrie was the writer. His first movie was also Public Access with Singer. He's now become Tom Cruise's right, and I do say that with W-R-I-T-E, hand man, working with him on a lot of his modern screenplays. Cruise's right-hand man for a long time was Robert Towne. From Days of Thunder on into the mid-90s and maybe in the later 90s with a lot of movies that he worked on. But now it's become McQuarrie who is directing, or did he direct one of the Mission Impossible movies? I think he directed the previous one, Rogue Nation. I think he's been involved in two or three of them at this point. But he always seems to be in the credit list on Tom Cruise's recent films. The WGA, so the Writers Guild, ranks this movie as 35th on the top 101 screenplays of all time.
So what do you make of that?
Bullshit. It's a good screenplay. Okay, although it doesn't hold together. But I can live with the not holding together thing. Fine, put it on there maybe in the 90s, but 35th? Casablanca, incidentally, is number one.
Oh, as it should be.
And that's understandable.
Usual Suspects simply doesn't make narrative sense. Perhaps because it's not a true narrative, it's a story being improvised by a mad genius, but that narrative is still 80% of the movie, and it's frustrating that it doesn't follow the rules. The characters' motivations prior to the threat from Sosei are super shallow. There's no adequate reason for why Keaton would work with them, or why they would work together at all. As I said before, it's all contrived conflict and contrived motivations. There's lots to love about this script. It deserves praise, particularly for the dialogue, which was made far stronger by good direction, by good actors. But the story as a whole, it has so many holes in it.
It's all about the twist, I think, for the WGA and for the people that like this movie. If it took that
the
away...
The dialogue, I mean, it's got some really good meaty lines.
Yeah, not as good as... I would say even Seven's got as good a dialogue, if not better, that same year, and it's not referenced the same way. And which movie is talked about more now, even though they're the same year, and even though they're both very popular? I mean, maybe people like Usual Suspects as much. IMDb would say so,
yeah,
but...
I think if you were to actually figure out who's talking about which movie more, I think Usual Suspects might be a bigger part of culture.
Okay. The producers were Brian Singer and Michael McDonald, who went on to do Urban Legend. Singer was a big player on House, because when you look at his IMDb credits, you see that he's got some Emmy nominations. Think, what the fuck did Singer ever do in television? But he was a producer on House, along with a lot of other people. Typically, there's 5, 6, 10 producers on TV shows. The movie is 235 to 1. We watched the Blu-ray from Andre. Again, we thank him. The cinematographer, Newton Thomas Siegel, who is a Singer regular. He shot Three Kings, though, for David O. Russell 4 years after this movie. That's an interesting-looking film. Great
very
looking film,
non-traditional
actually.
Cinematography.
And that movie was not given anywhere near enough credit and was not a big hit like it should have been. And he also shot Drive just a couple of years ago, but he tends to work with Singer the most. The editor and the composer was John Ottman, who's also a Singer regular. He composed, and I don't know if he edited, but he definitely composed on X2, X-Men United, and then Days of Future Past.
They just brought him in because they lost their composer at the 11th hour, but then he did such a great job, Singer's hired him over and over again.
Oh, I didn't realize that, really?
Yeah.
He was out of his element, but he was great at his element at the same
time?
Yeah,
he was obviously a musician. They asked him to give them something, to see what he could do, and they liked it, and they went with it. And he's worked with them tons since then.
A lot of actors are able to be good musicians as singers or guitarists, so there's no reason why an editor can't be a good composer, I suppose. Why not?
I know a ton of editors. I'm an editor, and virtually every editor I know is a huge music fan, and a great many of us play instruments. There's a connection between editing and music.
This music is almost Elfman-esque, by the way. Danny Elfman, especially Batman Returns. I noticed that a few times. It reminded me a lot of that score. Okay, I've mentioned a bunch of the influence I've written down here, so let's pick apart what I've got left. Like Princess Bride, we did just a few weeks ago, we're seeing someone's interpretation of events, so it may not be true. Princess Bride, that's okay, it's a fantasy story. It doesn't have to be exactly what the story is supposed to be. There is no actuality in that anyway. But in this one, as we've said many times, it's probably all bullshit, or at least a lot of it's bullshit. Four guys burying a dead body, Fenster, to cover up a crime, reminds of another recent movie we did, Deliverance.
Different kind of crime, different kind of body to bury.
Different logic as to why the person was killed. Brian Singer was influenced by Citizen Kane, Double Indemnity, and Rashomon, it says online, and those all make relative sense, especially Rashomon because of the unreliable narrators in that case. Many people telling a story and they don't match up. And then the biggest influence of all, and the reason why this movie is so famous, is it the best twist ending of all time? We had a Coming Attraction trivia question a long time ago, what's the best twist ending ever? And I included things like The Sixth Sense, Psycho, Planet of the Apes, Empire Strikes Back, Citizen Kane, and there's a ton of others, but is it the best?
It's a pretty stiff competition. Is it better than Planet of the Apes when it was Earth all along, people?
Or that Norman Bates is the actual killer? I Am Your Father, Rosebud's the Sled, Bruce Willis was dead all along, too.
At least two of those make far more narrative sense than Usual Suspects, in that it's just more elegantly put together than Usual Suspects.
I think if I went into Psycho, of all those ones I just mentioned, not knowing what the twist was, and I can't remember, I think I did know what the twist was before I ever saw that movie, that would have been the biggest shock for me. But it's hard to know because I did know it going in.
I didn't know it going into Psycho, although I watched the remake, Gus Van Sant version, before I watched the original.
Oh, what a
like
mistake.
A fool. I am a fool.
For some reason, that movie is on Netflix. They just put it on there recently.
Why does that movie exist? Never watched that. Just watched the original. But yeah, I went in not knowing. But I think the effect was lost on me because emotionally I wasn't remotely invested.
Well, if this movie is going to be 26 in the IMDb, then a ton of people would say this is the best twist ending that's ever been.
Listen, it's fun. I had a blast watching this movie for the first time. I was so thrilled and surprised. Give it credit where that credit is due. It is a cool twist.
It's clever. The awards in this section, the movie won 2 Oscars. It was only nominated for 2, Best Supporting Actor for Spacey and McQuarrie's Screenplay. He didn't write another thing until 2000, which Benicio Del Toro was in, The Way of the Gun, which I think I might like as much or even better than this movie.
I was thinking about The Way of the Gun. I always find that The Way of the Gun is this very realistic portrayal of how criminals would work together, where you have two people who know each other super well. They're almost like military in the way that they execute their crimes. They don't have to talk. They just have a system and they do things very slick and professional the way they behave. It's funny because I thought of that as this contrast. Here's a great example of a movie that does a great job at illustrating criminals at work. Usual Suspects, they're up there with the wisecracks. They're wearing their nylon masks and smoking through them because they're just so damn cool. And they're total strangers working together, yet they have this total flow and trust with each other. It's so silly. Whereas Way of the Gun does the complete opposite.
James Caan is very good in that movie too, as the older veteran. And Ryan Phillippe, it might be his best work ever.
And Sarah Silverman is in it for like a split second in a hilarious part. There's just a great scene where she's a mouthy broad in a lineup, giving them some guff.
All right, well, back to The Usual Suspects. With Spacey's disability in this movie and winning an Oscar, that's a bit of a cliche. And Eddie Murphy's character in Bowfinger made that very clear with that funny scene where he talks about, if I was a blind slave, I'd win an Oscar.
Or in Tropic Thunder, they talk about that, about how, I won't say it, but he doesn't go full disability.
You can quote it, full retard is what he says.
Okay, fine. But, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, he wins the Oscar because he has cerebral palsy. He wasn't actually intellectually disabled.
But Sean Penn and I Am Sam went full retard.
Yeah, yeah.
As he says in Tropic Thunder. But yeah, you have a disability and you have a good chance to win an Oscar.
But it's a fake disability. He fooled you all.
Well, the minute he walked out of that police station and didn't limp anymore and then shakes his left hand out and lights a cigarette, that's when he won the Oscar.
Apparently, to make it realistic, he glued his fingers together
to
force him to kind of have an awkward feeling with his hand and to keep those fingers together without it looking like he was flexing muscles to do it.
Kaiser Sose was 48th on the dark side of the heroes and villains list, which, by the way, I'm sure this is true about a lot of the villains on the list, including Norman Bates, gives away the movies if you haven't seen them already. Hannibal Lecter was number 1 on the villains list, by the way.
Doesn't give away anything to say. Actually, he's not the technical villain in Silence of the Lambs. Buffalo Bill is.
It's true, and is Hannibal Lecter really the best villain in the history of movies? I don't know. He's great, but is he the best? No. And then Darth Vader's in there.
Yeah, is he really
a
villain?
Vader's a tragic hero, really, when you look at the whole arc.
He killed all those children. He's a villain.
True. But I'm saying there are a few movies on that list that give away that the characters are bad guys.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen the movies, it's ruined.
Spoiler. Yeah. Although, it's been 22 years if you haven't seen this movie.
Well, when the villains list came out, and Heroes and Villains list came out, it wasn't 23 years. Usual Suspects was 10th in the mystery category of the top 100 genres. The Hitchcock-dominated top 100 genres mystery category. Vertigo was number 1. All right, last thoughts on TUS.
Snappy dialogue, good pacing, consistent tone, one fun scene after another are enough to make this a really good film. But Usual Suspects is just a little too dumb to be up there with the greats.
I agree. It requires repeat viewings if you care at all. A lot of people would say it doesn't require that. Roger Ebert was not a fan of this movie.
No, he put it on his list of his most hated
and
films.
And I'm sure he never watched it again. But if you do care at all, then you have to see it more than once to pick it apart. For the good or for the bad. It still doesn't sing for me. Okay. It's clever. The actors are pretty great. But it feels like a bit of a fuck you to the audience as well. Especially at the very ending. And twist movies always risk looking pretty dumb under close scrutiny. And this one isn't pretty dumb, but it's not as good as it could be.
Yeah, it's a cheap trick, right?
It's not as great as it seems, as you said when you were young when you first saw it. Okay, next week on the Next 100 Project, we'll get ourselves thrown in the hoosegow and work the chain gang alongside the marvelous Paul Newman in one of his best ever roles in Cool Hand Luke. The coming attraction trivia for Cool Hand Luke. What we've got here is failure to communicate. Was 11th on AFI's Top 100 Quotes list. The line was made famous by Struther Martin, a supporting actor in Cool Hand Luke, but was later repeated in the movie by the star Paul Newman. How many of AFI's top 10 quotes were said by supporting players but not the top billed actor?
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Cool Hand Luke. Check out our website, top100project.com. Don't you forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We have covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 films that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And in return for all these free podcasts, rate us, review us. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Fucking cops. And like that, we're gone.
And cut.